Next case is 00942, State of Ohio versus Donald Muncy. Please wait till I call on you.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Hunt. Well, your co-counsel would like to be able to take notes, I think, so I'd like to make sure he's seated.
Yeah, my name is Jim Hunt. It's my pleasure to hear this morning on behalf of my client, Donald Muncy. May I please report, I would also like to acknowledge the county executive on each of you here this morning. And when we were completed alongside county, I'd like to thank them for their support and need to respond to this matter. We have a pretty narrow issue to deal with here, and that is whether or not we have a final appeal of order. I think it's interesting that issue just came up in the case before me. And before I get too far into this, I would like to say 5 minutes for rebuttal.
You need to watch your time there on the clock.
Here I am in the Supreme Court of Ohio, and I'm still looking for an answer to the question, and that is, if Don Muncy didn't have a final appealable order at the time that Judge Walker ordered that he was forcibly medicated, he would be strapped down if necessary and injected with medicines that he didn't want to get, and that was to be done without giving Don the opportunity to be heard, when, in good conscience, does that become a final appealable order? If it's not at the time that it occurs, when does it become final and appealable? I don't want to be a little cynical here, but it seems to me that if we had not appealed at that point, and if we had simply waited until this case was over, and then tried to appeal from that particular issue, the state would be arguing we waived it, because we should have raised it at the time. To me, it's very clear that if you look at 2505.02, and I don't want to repeat everything that's in the brief, but, you know, to me, if you look at the statute, especially subsection 4A and B, I mean, we have obviously what is a provisional proceeding here. We have something that's going on that's ancillary to the underlying criminal charge, and that is the determination that Don was incompetent to stand trial.
For purposes of argument only, and maybe more, I want to assume that it's a final appealable order. If that's the case, isn't the Steele case dispositive of this?
Well, I was actually going to open my presentation this morning by telling you, I was a couple of weeks ago, I got these materials out and started to go over them. And I was trying to think, we've got a narrow issue here, but the constitutional issues in the Muncy case are kind of just, to me, rampant, almost pregnant, and needing to be addressed.
And there was Steele.
I was trying to figure out some way, how can I sneak that in, and then all of a sudden, you all decide the Sullivan case. And so the whole statute now on competence, and the statute that Don was found incompetent under, has been thrown out. So where does that leave us? Well, it leaves us under the old statute.
Well, and doesn't, even though it's in the civil context, Steele provides for a hearing.
Absolutely, Ron.
And wouldn't that be dispositive in the criminal context, forgetting the Sullivan case? Because I think it's interesting. You cite the Sullivan case as really good authority, as additional authority, and so does he.
Well, you know, I think Mr. Hoffman, and I respect this position here, I think he was being an officer of the court more than anything else, and I'm interested to hear what Dave has to say about how that case helps him.
So am I. And I want to hear how it helps you.
Well, I
just threw out the statute.
Well, you threw
and then
out
we
the
said which way they go. Go to the probate court. I mean, yeah.
That's fine.
Commitment.
Because if you go to probate court under Steele, Your Honor, what happens? You have a hearing. You have the opportunity to be heard. And, you know, that's the other, I mean, again, maybe I'm wrong, but it seems beautiful that every step, even the Court of Appeals in this case, said, you know, well, of course, everybody knows you have to have a hearing. before you forcibly medicate somebody. Everybody knows that. Well, and they said that in their decision, Your Honor, but it's dicta.
Other than making that very important decision about a constitutional right and the right to hearing and due process and all those things we didn't steal, why isn't this case moot? Sounds to me like the doctor was right. Treats him, he's fine, he's all right now.
You know, I wish I would have brought, you know, in fact, I invited Mr. Muncy here today. I'm sorry that he can't be here. But he wrote to me, and he told me that he's very interested in this case. You know, Don is doing fine right now. He's taking his medicine, and his life has gotten better, and you know, he's able to see his son, which was the whole thing that got this business started. But we have a situation, Your Honor, where the Ohio Department of Mental Health continues to be responsible for evaluating people that are found incompetent to stand trial, where it continues to make recommendations that they receive medications. And we have an inconsistent application of that process, because in some counties, hearings are afforded, and in Claremont County, hearings are not afforded.
But why would we want to upset what seems to be now a good solution? What if we say, yep, he's entitled to a hearing, he quit taking his medicine, he can't be forcibly medicated, and we start the whole process over?
You're not deciding whether Don should be forcibly medicated.
The order will affect him, unless we make it prospective.
I think it has to be prospective, right? At least under the circumstances of this case. I don't think we have a mootness situation here, certainly because the Ohio Department of Mental Health continues to operate in this venue. They continue to either give you a hearing or not give you a hearing. We have dicta from the Court of Appeals pertaining to Claremont County, which says that you have to have a hearing, but we don't have a holding. And the only court that can lay down the law and say, you know, yeah, in this proceeding, in this setting, when you have a person accused of a crime who's determined to be incompetent, still applies.
What if we just say it's a final appealable order and stop?
Well, I'm hoping you won't do that.
But that's the issue in this case.
That's the issue we came up on. But I don't see how we can ignore, and that's why I indicated before Sullivan, I was thinking, you know, I really have to talk about the constitutionality of this, because it stinks. I mean, you cannot allow a situation where somebody is found to be incompetent, is paranoid schizophrenic, and doesn't have the opportunity to come in to court and object to an order that violates, you know, one of those fundamental rights we have, and that is to decide whether or not I'm going to take this medicine.
I didn't go back and check, but it seems to me the state says the only issue that this is before us, the only issue we allowed it in on, is final appealable order. Is that accurate?
That's correct, Your Honor. You did, in allowing jurisdiction in this matter, clearly it was just on that narrow issue. But I don't see how we can get here and just look at that narrow issue and not look at the broader context, and that is, you know, if you're going to give due process in Steele, if you're going to specify in Sullivan what due process is all about when you determine somebody to be incompetent, how can you stop and not also then extend due process to the situation where somebody says, you've got to take this medicine even though you don't want to take this medicine?
There's not even a proposition of law in before the court on that subject, due process.
I thought that we...
I just see one proposition.
We raised it in court of appeals. That's my only, I guess, response to that. You're correct. Mm-hmm. And we did that because, again, we weren't allowed in on that particular narrow issue. And we didn't agree. But it seems to me that it's a given. Because I don't think the state is going to argue that somebody is not entitled to at least come in and be heard.
But shouldn't this person follow the procedures that are set forth in Steele rather than appealing it this way? Wouldn't that be a better way to proceed in the probate court?
Well, it seems to me, even in Steele, there's going to be a hearing of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
Here there was no hearing.
I know. That's
so that's the issue. We're not here to decide whether Judge Walker was correct or incorrect at this point. We're here simply to say that Judge Walker was incorrect in not letting Don Muncy be heard as to why he didn't want to take 4,000 milligrams of Depakote every day. I mean, maybe I'm not answering your question.
Well, No, I'm just thinking about whether that it's proper in the criminal court, or should he have brought an action in the probate court under the procedures of Steele?
Well, you mean as a sort of an ancillary way to get it out? I mean, it seems to me that the most efficient way to deal with this issue is to look at it in the context in which it arose here, and that is the determination of incompetence, a request by a doctor for forced medication, and whether a person has a right to be heard. And you know, again, we're not here today appealing.
Well, I think that we've indicated that in Steele, that he certainly has a right to be heard.
It's the involuntary hospitalization context, which is, you know, I guess you could examine it from underlying state interests and so forth and decide that maybe there's a different state interest in determinations of incompetence versus the determinations of whether somebody has to be involuntarily hospitalized or not. But it seems to me that the bottom line is that if you're talking about invading somebody's body with medicine that they don't want to take, whether it comes up in the context of 5122 or competence here, that is a fundamental right. There's a fundamental right that's involved, and you ought to be heard. And due process requires that you be heard. And again, I'm still standing here and I'm waiting, and maybe Mr. Hoffman will answer the question. When is it? When did Don Muncy have a final appealable order? Or is this court going to say, well, you know, if a judge orders you to take this medicine that you don't want to take and doesn't give you an opportunity to be heard about it, you never have a final appealable order. I mean, if that's the law, then the law's not right.
He was found incompetent to stand trial.
He was, correct.
Does that equate to the medical and or clinical definition of incompetency?
It's a legal standard.
Because unless he's found incompetent, he has a right to refuse without any hearing.
That's correct. And he did refuse, Your Honor.
Yeah, I understand what happened.
He was taken by force and held down.
I understand.
And things were injected into him.
That says, then, for all purposes, he was incompetent, doesn't it?
No.
Pursuant to Steele.
Not at all. No, because the issue...
For instance, could he have drawn a will while he was committed?
Yes.
Under the statute, he could.
Yes, he could. Yes, he could.
Could he have deeded property?
He could have.
Could he have married?
He could have.
Could he have divorced?
He could have done those things.
Was he incompetent?
He was competent for some purposes. The determination made by the trial court was whether he was incompetent to stand trial. Could he assist in his defense? Did he understand the issues that pertain to his case? Those kinds of things. Those are different from, did Don Muncy understand what Depakote was? Did he know what it did to his person because he had experience with it in the past? Certainly a person can be found incompetent to stand trial, but retain competence to make the decisions, determinations, and at least have some input into whether or not medicines with known side effects, I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court cites a 25% rate of known side effects with these drugs. A person certainly retains the right, I would think, and the competence to at least have some input into that decision-making. And that's not at all the same as determining whether a person's competent to stand trial. They're different issues.
Then maybe the error, if there was one, is the court's response in writing to the letter from the hospital.
I appreciated Judge Walker's forthrightness in providing us with that information, but I agree it was basically like an ex parte order. He contacted, I guess I can't blame the Department of Mental Health. I don't want to have to go into court every time they're forced to medicate somebody. But gee whiz, expedience certainly is not an excuse to allow a violation of somebody's fundamental rights.
I want to make sure I understand what the legal issue here is. We touched on it, but isn't your strongest argument that on the legal issue, whether this is a final appealable order, that this is an ancillary proceeding because it's a provisional, under the statute's definition, it's a provisional proceeding, and that the court of appeals read out of the statute, but not limited to,
right.
Those words not limited to, and if you read those in, then this becomes a proceeding that's ancillary to an action, and that makes it a final appealable order. That's
absolutely
the court of appeals should have treated it that way, and So the Court of Appeals erred. We should reverse on that basis. Is that?
That's the term of the argument, absolutely. And that to wait and not allow the appeal at the time would leave the defendant.
Because there's nothing. His rights have been obviously been affected by that time. He can't undo that. And so it's just one of the tests for.
That's absolutely what we stand. But then if you reach that holding, then they still have the issue hanging out there as to whether or not it violates due process not to have somebody, allow somebody to have a hearing. And you have dictum in the Court of Appeals, but you don't have a holding to that.
Have you been retained by Mr. Muncy? How do you get here?
Your Honor, I get here because a couple of years ago, Judge Walker called me on the telephone and said,
have we heard that story?
I'm retained to teach law and psychiatry. I've got a case for you. And I'm happy to say, actually, that I've taken on Mr. Muncy's case, not on just this issue, but I've also been able to assist him in getting him back into the situation now where he's integrated back into the community, and he's actually about to visit his son, and he's taking his medicine.
So vicariously, Mr. Huffman's paying you. Is that it?
Thank you, Mr. Huffman.
That's actually all totally pro bono, Your Honor.
That was what I was asking.
Thank you, Mr. Hunt. Mr. Huffman.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. The state's position is the forced medication order is not a final order under the for two reasons. Because it doesn't fulfill the requirements of a provisional remedy of a final order statute. And also because the competing interests that would be addressed by a direct appeal do not accurately or effectively be served by an appeal from the forced med order.
Tell me why. Convince me that this is not an ancillary proceeding or a provisional remedy. I think the Court of Appeals is wrong, so convince me that the Court of Appeals is not, because they just simply read out the statute, but not limited to. They confined the statute to the words that a proceeding for preliminary injunction, attachment, discovery, privilege matter, so forth, but the statute also says it's not limited to those kinds of actions. So why then is the Court of Appeals correct in limiting it?
Well, I think that if the Court of Appeals took the approach that the changes in the final order statute or this provisional remedies language was enacted, simply codified existing law and didn't seek to expand upon those final orders in criminal cases that existed prior to the amendment. And I do the appeals in the prosecutor's office in Claremont County. I know full well that we have to appeal a motion to suppress that was decided against us. We have to allege that decision ditched our case. We can't go on. It finishes the whole case. We have to sign that.
Well, for him, if it is, if let's assume it's a provisional remedy, the hearing at which it's determined whether he's going to be given drugs he doesn't want, and trial court says, yeah, you can go ahead and give the drugs, so he gets the drugs, it's over, isn't it, for him? I mean, that issue has been resolved without anybody reviewing the decision by the trial court, doesn't it? That seems to me to be a classic case of the language in 02, which I don't have it right in front of me, but...
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's too late. By the time you get to the Court of Appeals after the conviction, it's too late. The medication has already been administered, and that's a problem that was mentioned in federal cases. Brandon mentioned that too.
Let's assume it was an amputation. I mean, to make it graphic, and my arm's gone, but I can appeal later on with my one arm. I mean, isn't that the issue here? That
well, the two interests that would be served in the amicus brief for Muncy and also Muncy's merit brief are two. First, that the dosage might be too high, and the second, that a recognition or ratification of a right to refuse treatment. Those are the two interests that are proposed that would be served by an intermediate appeal.
Counsel?
Yeah. Yes.
I had to take a common meeting when I had the tonsils out. I had one dose. I had a very traumatic, severe psychotropic reaction. So I kind of have first-hand fear of psychotropic medicine. And I, too, am struggling with how in the world we don't find that to be
correct.
You are saying that medicine is positive and not being sure about medication. The only hope remedy to fix them is to make them take these drugs. Why is that a remedy? It's a provisional remedy. Why, I'm still struggling with why you say that that doesn't fit into the statute. A fundamental right to take medication or not take medication. Once taken, it's done and over with. Severe side effects, it's not a provisional remedy.
Well, I would read the provisional remedy definition as including those two subsections that have additional requirements. The first that Justice Moyer mentioned, and the other that it determines the action with respect to the provisional remedy and prevents a judgment in the action in favor of the appealing party. The amicus of the state brought out that
You determine the action.
I don't think that's what that means. The way it's worded, why wouldn't they say then that it determines the provisional remedy? Why do they say it has to determine the action with respect to this provisional remedy? Well, the position taken is that...
The action.
It's like a glove with my earlier illustration with a 12J appeal.
If you read it the way you read it, then you have to determine entire losses. That there can be nothing within a suit. If you read it the way you read it, the whole action has to be determined. Well, that's not the purpose of the statute. The statute is dealing with items within a case that can be appealed. We all know once a final case is resolved, it can be appealed. These determine when items happen, preliminary injunctions, and other things. They happen within a case. We're not talking about the action being the whole case, or you would have nothing within the case appealed once you're dead.
I don't mean to duck behind this, but I just do criminal law. And my experience is in the criminal law, this is extremely restricted in the criminal laws of what a final order is. There's only one thing I have, basically, is a final order, and that's when the state loses the motion to suppress it.
He lost his decision to take a medication. Why isn't that comparable to a state losing the motion to suppress?
Well, another problem I have is I don't see why the necessity of an appeal determines the due process questions of both. The fact that there could be a hearing. Now, the Court of Appeals already found that his denial of a hearing in this case was wrong.
Yeah.
But the fact that a person has a hearing in front of a judge, that seems to me a pretty good guarantee of due process. Why does the availability of immediate review in that situation, or the lack thereof, instantly mean that there's a deprivation of due process? There are lots of things that you can't appeal. And it doesn't mean there's a deprivation of due process. It seems like it's an assumption in the cases that...
Because the issues being appealed are different. Here you have an absolute invasion of the body politic, which in fact is sacrosanct. You don't have the right to do that under the Liberty Clause.
That's another point that bothers me in the brief. It says that there is no government interest that can override that. It says that the briefs for the amicus for the Muncie and also Muncie brief treat that interest as if it can never be limited by anything.
We handled that in Steele. He said if it's an emergency, they can go ahead and medicate. So that was taken care of. But here you have somebody who's never been clinically determined to be incompetent. You have one trial judge saying, yep, he can't stand trial. And now we're going to not only put him away, but we're going to strap him down, give him whatever we think he ought to have for his own benefit, without first giving him a chance to say, wait a minute, first of all, I am competent to know I don't want this. And if you think I'm not competent to make that decision, pursuant to Steele, at least I should have a hearing.
Well, no.
What's wrong with that?
That's not what the appeal's about. This appeal is not about whether a person can have a hearing or not. I think I already lost that in the Court of Appeals.
No, you haven't. Oh, yeah, the Court of Appeals ruled for you. I know what they said.
It's an issue, but they put right in there that a person ought to have a hearing.
Is that the whole of the case? The whole of the case was it was not a final appealable order.
I think a trial judge, when he gets that opinion back, wouldn't have to have holding written on it. I think he'd get the message from what they said.
Good. Well, if we said that, then he'd really get the message, right?
That's true.
Okay.
That's true,
I got it.
There's a different government interest in this case than there was in Steele. It's been described as a very important overriding government interest, and that's for the government to determine the guilt or innocence of the person accused of the crime.
Why'd you cite Sullivan to us as additional authority?
Well, I thought it was important that the court know that we were all going to be on the same page, that we knew that the statute's been pulled out from under us and that we were going to be arguing this case with that in mind.
Is there anything in Sullivan that buttresses your case?
Well, the first thing that occurred to me was that if we revert to the old statute, that's the statute that Hunt was addressing. And it doesn't contain a forced med provision, though.
That's right.
There's a little bit of an impediment, I guess. But the strangest thing about this case is that you can't change history. We've had a happy ending here, and everything's happened already, and it's kind of difficult to go back and say that the wrong
statute. Well, isn't the problem, though, that there's a legal issue that maybe others would want to know what our view is on it?
Well, sure.
Like the final appeal of order issue, I mean, that's something that's going to occur again. This is not just between an issue between your client and you know the state and the defendant. Hopefully it's not, because we should have taken the case if that's the issue. Isn't that right? Am I right? I mean, the issue is, how do we apply the final appeal of order law? And there seems to be some issue here, assuming Sullivan doesn't make it all moot, but...
Well, I noticed that in Sullivan. I think the appellate court in Sullivan had a separate judgment finding on the issue of final appeal order, and in that case, that rendered that issue, I guess, it just wasn't addressed by this court in Sullivan. And it will recur. And how can you look at it if it's not final order? How can you review a statute if the application was set,
but resulted in an order that's final?
I understand that.
Maybe you've already answered this, but what is your position on whether this is a provisional remedy? What did you say?
Oh, thank you. I didn't get to that.
Oh, you didn't. Okay.
I was about to.
That's what I would like to hear is your, do you believe that this is a provisional remedy ancillary to the action?
The non-exclusive list for that provisional remedies lists only motions to suppress.
Well, it lists more than that. It actually lists discovery of privileged matter, and I'm sorry.
That could be civil criminal.
Yeah, it could be criminal.
Yeah.
And if that falls under a provisional remedy, it would appear that forced medication is certainly more serious than discovery of privileged matter. So I'd like you to address that, and why isn't this a provisional remedy?
Well, I think that I haven't found a criminal case that found that the discovery issue in the criminal context was a final appeal order. Actually, I can't think of one. I looked at all the listings and I couldn't find one.
I think we had one, and I can't recall the name, but Justice Wright wrote the decision a number of years ago.
That was a lady with the cancer and the reverend.
Was it? Yeah. I can't remember the name of the case.
In my brief, I took the definition of provisional remedy and took the position that because the motion to suppress was the only essentially criminal example provided in the statute, that it showed an intention on the part of the General Assembly to limit that to criminal context. And then the amicus of the state I was mentioning in subparagraph A or section A, stated that the determination of the actual action, of the whole action, underlying action, I believe is the way it would read with logic, would be necessary for the provisional remedy to be final and appealable. And what I was stating was that with my experience with state appeals for motions to suppress, that is essentially what a state has, what the government has to allege before it can file an interlocutory appeal from an adverse decision for motion to suppress. It has to allege that the case is essentially determined because of that adverse ruling. And because of that, the state can file an appeal prior to the entry of judgment. And that, to my mind, is the only traditional exception to the general rule in criminal cases that the final order, that the judgment, conviction, sentence is the final order in a criminal case. And so that's the best I can do, Your Honor, in addressing that question.
To summarize, I'd like to state that overriding government interest, that the interest of the defendant in his bodily integrity is not without limit. We don't have unlimited rights. You can never have unlimited personal rights. They must always defend the rights of others. Otherwise, you have anarchy. And in this case, the government interest of determining the guilt or innocence of those accused of crime is a valid and important limitation upon that right. And the interests served in allowing a direct appeal would seriously hamper, and there could be horror stories if direct appeals could be allowed from final forced medication orders, years of people being kept in confinement without treatment for tactical reasons. I would ask that the court consider that and address this issue. And I ask that the judgment of the Court of Appeals be affirmed. Turn over the question.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Mr. Hunt, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Quickly, Your Honor, let me just say this. What we're seeking here today is not only determination we're appealing from the final appeal of the order, but we're also seeking this court's determination and this court's holding that all those guarantees the court discussed in analyzing the Steele case ought to be extended to and applied to this situation as well. I don't think it's enough for this court to say, yes, you do have a final appeal of the order, which works in your hands before the appeals to that court. I think if that's going to be the first holding, it ought to come.
Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.